I think the first time I heard that song, it was a man by the name of Jim Bohai who sang it. He was a tenor. Thank you, sir. A tenor, and he was at the Landmark Baptist Temple just north of Cincinnati, and I remember he would go up when I fell beneath the load, and he'd be real high. He sang it considerably higher than you did. And he would hold that up and his face would get red and he is just pouring his heart into it. And I went home and tried to sing like Jim Bohai. Never did accomplish it. But I enjoy the song and thank you so much. Thank you for being here tonight. Your faithful attendance has meant so much. And I know this is Saturday night. And I would tell you that I'd let you out early, but I don't want to lie to you. When I get up here and get going, I have no idea what's going to happen next. So I will try to be conscious of a busy week and late evenings and try to take that in consideration. Last night we talked about grace. Tonight I want to talk with you about a counterpart of that that is called faith. We have some really crazy ideas sometimes about what faith is. I remember reading a story about a little girl that lived on a farm in outside. Her best friend lived just down the lane. But there was a little hill between her house and her friend's house. And she always wished that hill would not be there because she could look and see if her friend's light was on and tell if she was there and she could run talk to her or whatever. And she went to church and the preacher preached that if we had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you could remove that mountain. And so her face lit up and she said, I can't wait till I get home. So they got home and she ran in the living room and got down on her knees and prayed, Lord, I believe you to move that hill out of the way so I can see. So I can see my friend's house. And she jumped up and ran to the window and pulled apart the curtains and she said, I knew it wasn't going to happen. And turned and walked away. There's two big lessons there, all right? If you're praying and you know it's not going to happen, you don't have much faith. The other thing is this idea of faith is not a slot machine that you plug in your quarter and jerk the handle and you get a cascade of things, everything your heart could desire. It's not a way to manipulate God. And I have heard some pretty scary things that people have batted around about what they can do through faith. Another thing that I just absolutely do not believe is this prosperity gospel that if we just say it, then we ought to have it. That's not what my Bible teaches. It said in this world you will have tribulation. There will be persecution when you follow Christ. The promise is, keep your head up because I've overcome the world. And I can help you overcome the world. So, I want to talk about faith. Now, the Bible has a lot of good things to say about faith. And I want to look at some verses from obviously, Hebrews chapter 11, but I want to go backwards a few verses and pick up a couple of statements in chapter 10. And actually, the preface or the lead into chapter 11 of Hebrews begins at the last two or three verses of chapter 10 as well. And to give you a little bit of context, obviously, we don't have total clarity on who the author of of Hebrews was. But in this time frame, there's a lot going on in the world. And the basic struggle that we see, on one side, we have scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees and those leaders of the church that were brilliant people. But they also were prideful and haughty. They were given to extreme detail in some areas. You can just see these old miserly guys out there counting the seeds. My dad grew up on a farm in Indiana, and he moved to the city when God called him there. And God took him out of the country, but God didn't ever take the country out of my dad. So we lived in a little house in Cincinnati, a tall house and skinny house, and the yard was maybe a third of the size of this sanctuary. But my dad would always grow things because there was something down on the inside when the weather began to break and things began to warm up, and he'd grow things, and he bought bulbs that he would plant in the ground that you couldn't see most of the year. But in the spring, he was out there looking for his crocuses and then his daffodils and his big amarilla lilies and all these kinds of things. I have seen him surround our whole front yard with like three or four rows of different flowers. And he would plant them graded in according to height. And so in the back was the bigger ones, and he would fertilize until you would have a border of flowers that would be a yard wide. And we lived in a predominantly black community. I was the only white boy there for years, except for the people from God's Bible School. And I actually made it through the racial riots of the 60s, and they threw bricks through our windows. And I had a group of black fellas that jumped me, and for years I had little scars down my back where they nicked it with a knife as they were threatening me. All right? But there was a couple of black ladies that lived across the street from us, and they were big ladies. And they had a big old smile and a big voice, and they'd come out and say, "Ooh, ooh, man, look at them flowers. Ooh, man, that guy got a touch." My dad did have a touch. And he loved to plant those flowers, and we would order packets of flower seeds from a place called Burpee's Seeds. And you tear the top off and look down in there, and there's all those seeds. And I can just see them, these scribes and Pharisees, carefully dumping out those seeds in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and one for God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, counting out the seeds. And see, they were supposed to pay a tithe, and so they didn't want to give God any more than his tenth. Isn't that crazy? God gets one-tenth, that's his share, and all the rest is mine. You know? And so they were precise, and they were exact, and they knew to the most minute detail exactly what the law demanded. But they were empty and without compassion and cruel and mean and hateful and bigoted. You see, they were an extreme over here. On the other side, you had awful paganism. In that day, they often would include immoral sexual acts in their worship. They would have a whole building full of women just for sexual activity that people could participate in an act of worship because they had sunk so low. So you have debauchery on one side and blind legalism on the other side. And in the middle, you have Christ with a group of disciples, and you have men like Paul and Peter, and they're trying to walk this path down the middle between the extremes on both sides. Now, folks, that's not any different than the day in which we live. Is it? No, it's not. We got people on this side just throwing everything out the window. Do what you want. And we got people over here that want to draw another line for every single thing that ever, you know, and it's, well, we got to make another law. We got to make another rule. And then it's not, what does the Lord say? And this says, thus saith the Lord. But it says, now according to our law, well, I'm not interested in your law. I'm interested in the law of God. Now, I am a part of a church, and I voluntarily place myself under the law of that church. Because if I didn't agree with it, I wouldn't have joined them. I wouldn't have been a part of them. I wouldn't hold my preaching credentials through them. So I voluntarily do that, and I've looked over that, and I say, yeah, I can live with that. It's not that I agree with every single minute detail, but basically I can live under that and have the liberty to serve God and work for God and influence God for God and righteousness' sake, all right? But we have a whole bunch of people that are just so far over here, they're back to counting seeds. 8, 9, 1 for God. 7, 8, 9, 2 for God. 1, you know. Now, here's the thing that we need to understand. This is a ditch that we want to avoid. And that is a ditch that we want to avoid. I have nothing in me that wants to throw everything out the window and go my own way. On the other hand, I have nothing in me that wants to crawl in this cave and just, you know, look out. Oh, let's see. Oh, well, that's something new. Well, what can we do? Okay, let's draw another line here. And the idea that the bigger the marker that I have, then the more holy I am, all right? And the devil is perfectly content to push you into a siding on either side of the road. He doesn't care if you're way out here, let's see, you're safe, way out here in left field and throwing everything out the window and saying, I'm going to do what I jolly well please, all right? He said, that's great. I got you right where I want you. Why? Because I'm off the road and I'm onto a siding or I'm in the ditch. And he will let you stay there and he will encourage you to stay there until the end of time. Because if you're on the siding, you're not having any effect on the people that are on the road to heaven or to hell. None whatsoever, because you're on the siding. But by the same token, if he can't get me to go that way, he'll push me this way and push me this way and push me this way until I'm clear off here on a siding and he's content to let me sit over here on a legalistic siding because the exact same thing is happening on both sides. You're both wrong. You're both an extreme on one side. And here's what it does. Andrew, can I pick on you? All right. I look at Andrew, he's my friend. And I look at my life and I think, you know, I've been noticing some things in Andrew's life that I'm not really happy with. I think he's getting a little off on the right, off on the left here. He's sort of turning loose of this and that and the other thing. And as I consider my life, I'm saying, now what am I going to do? So I don't want to go that way, so I step this way. And that's fine. And then Andrew's friend Jonathan comes along and he says, oh, you're just being legalistic. So I said, well, I don't want to be legalistic, so I step back this way. And then Rudy comes along and he said, you're just going off the board. You're just throwing everything out the window. You're going worldly. I don't want to be worldly, so I'm stepping back this way. And then Richard comes along and he said, man, oh man, what's happened to you? You just gone clear off the end on the right side. I don't want to be that. And so what the devil does, there will always be someone to your right or someone to your left. And what the devil wants you to do is focus on one side or the other. Folks, what you need to focus on is God. Keep your eyes on Him. Put every ounce of energy in being like Jesus, and the world will go by the wayside. You won't have to worry about the world, because if you're headed as hard as you can go in God's direction, the world is headed as hard as it can go in the opposite direction. They will leave you behind and have nothing to do with you. But you, the minute I begin looking this way and that way and comparing myself among ourselves and looking at this person, that person, and the devil knows exactly what I'm struggling with. And if it is worldliness and I'm scared to death of legalism, he will keep pointing out all the legalistic people, and as they get closer, I go farther to the right, to the left. But if my problem is the other way, then he'll keep pointing, oh, you can't do that, that's worldly, okay? And he'll just keep pushing me until I'm clear out of the picture and not doing anything. But what I want to talk about is this walk of faith that walks that line between the extremes on both sides and is alive and vital and spirit-led and spirit-filled and makes a difference and leaves an impact on our world. Folks, that is what we as a church are called to do. We're not here to play games on one side or the other. It's not a team that I'm going to be on that one or I'm going to be on this one or I'm not going to be. No, I am on God's side. He owns my heart. He owns my will. He owns my goals. He holds all of that in His hands, and I am headed in His direction as hard as I can go. I am living a walk. I am walking a walk of faith and living a life of faith. Because He has promised that if I am faithful at the end of this road, I will receive the reward that is given us. Now, as we see the uncertainty and the problems all around us, it is as natural as breathing to start saying, oh no, what do I do? My friend here has always been my friend, and they're going really crazy over this way. Or this one has always been my friend and good, close personal friend, and they're spinning off in this direction. And that is the moment that you stop all of it and you fall on your knees and say, Lord, I love You with every ounce of my being. My goal is not to please. I would love it if everyone agreed with me and if everyone loved me and everyone respected me and everyone was walking along with me. But if nobody goes with me, I'm going in Your direction. And I'm going to keep my eyes on You and on that city and on that prize, because I have everything to gain and everything to lose. And I want to lose all that I'm going to lose down here. I'm going to walk a walk of faith. Now, let me warn you, the devil will never give up the fight, because he doesn't want you there where God can use you. He wants you there where you're doing nothing, or there where you're doing nothing. The only thing you're doing there is defending your position. And the minute it gets a little unstable, you push harder in that direction. You don't believe me? You look at a person that has suddenly decided, they were raised like we were, and they decided, this is a bunch of nonsense, I'm going to do what I want to do. They don't stop until they hit the wall on that side. They throw everything overboard and out the window. And they run, and they run, and they run. And if it even looks like something that would put strictures on them, they're not going to have anyone at all telling them anything at all to do. They are going to do what they want to do, and they just keep running, and they can't get far enough, and they never stop. And you say, what in the world is going on? Now, the same is happening on the other side. And when I see my friends just throwing things out the window, something grabs a hold of my heart. And you know what the very first response in my heart from a human standpoint is? I need to do something to guard against that. I have no desire to go the way of the world. And so I turn my back, and what do? I run in the other direction. I have a very dear friend that was raised in the same exact setting that I was raised in. And that person is a hard, cantankerous, angry, dried up soul right now. And if you looked at him on the outside, you may say that he looks as godly as anyone you've ever seen. But his soul is withered and dry because he's lost his way and got off the road. He's in a ditch that apart from the grace of God, he will never climb out of. The hardest thing you will do is keep your balance on this road of faith while everyone else is spinning off in one direction or another. There's two or three things. Number one, don't try to do it yourself. We go together as a group. We go together as a family of God. We gather our family around us and we pray and we seek God and we read his word. But we're going to continue to walk in a careful, balanced manner because we're trying to be pleasing to God. All right. Now, well, all of that is free. That is not in my notes anywhere. Let's look at this idea of faith. The idea of there are extremes on both sides and that we need to walk a walk of faith down the middle. That is right here in my notes, okay? And then I went a little farther. If we go back to chapter 10, verse 22, verse 23, it's setting us up for this. It says, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith. I want you to know that when you are doing your best to live for God and to be pleasing to him, you have every right in this world to walk straight into the throne room of God with all the confidence in the world because he's invited you to come as a son. You know, I do a lot of traveling. The last several years, 6, 7 years, I put 23,000 miles on my vehicle just in Mexico alone. Last year I had almost 60,000 miles of travel between Mexico and the United States. I travel all over. I'm here in White House, Texas, and the pastor and his wife have made me very, very well. In fact, they gave me a key. I got a key to the house. All right? But you know what? That's not my house. I don't just walk into their house. I got back today. They were there. They knew I was coming. But when I got there, I knocked on the door because that's not my house. And I knocked on the door and I said, hello, I'm back. You see, I didn't want to intrude on them because it's their house. But there was, until my parents died, there was a house in Cincinnati that I was welcome any time of day or night. And when I got there, I simply ran up on the back door and grabbed that doorknob and slung the door open. Hey, Mom, I'm home. What you got to eat? What's the difference? I was a son. That was my father's house. They let me know that I could come in the middle of the night if I was on the road. I didn't have to call. I didn't have to do anything. When I got there, I just turned the knob and walked right on in because I belonged. I was a part of that family. That was my family home. And that's the way it is when he says in Hebrews chapter 4, let us therefore come boldly into the throne of grace to find mercy and grace to help us in our time of need. What is it? It's not a crass callousness in just running over top. No. That's not it at all. We have been invited by the Father himself to come right into his presence. And he said, you can tell me anything you want, and I'll listen, and I'll help you, and I'll supply your needs, and I'll be what you need me to be. Why? Because I'm a son. I belong to him. He invites me to come. So we draw near with a true heart and full assurance of the faith. And then in verse 23, it said, let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering. Why? And it answers it there in the last part, for he is faithful that promised. He is faithful that promised. So you say, what is faith? If it's not just plugging in our 10-cent prayer and hoping that we get a $1,000 return, what is this faith? Well, the Bible gives us some answers with that as well. And it talks specifically about the... One of the things that fascinates me from Hebrews chapter 11 is it mentions a man there by the name of Enoch. Enoch is only mentioned 4 or 5 times. And it says Enoch was translated to heaven, and the only thing it tells us here was that he pleased God. Well, that's what I want to do. I want to please God. What does the very next verse say? Now, without faith, it is impossible to please God. So that tells me that God walked with Enoch on a daily basis, and one day they walk so far, God looks over at him and says, Enoch, we're closer to my house than we are yours. Why don't you just come home with me? Enoch says, all right, I believe it will. Come spend the night. He's been there ever since because there is no night in heaven. Heard an old-time preacher tell that one time. But I'm serious. The only thing we know about Enoch was that he walked with God, that he pleased God, and that he had a bunch of children, and that he didn't die. And the reason he didn't die was because he pleased God. And it's impossible to please God without faith. And so we know that Enoch was a man of faith by deductive reasoning. And I say, I'm not really interested in going to heaven without dying. I mean, if that's the way the Lord wants to take me, that's great. But I desperately want to be a man that pleases God. And that means that I have to be a man of faith. And so I need to find out what God says when I'm talking about faith. So we have a whole lot of things that we can look at. If we look in 37, it says, for yet a little while, and he that shall come will come and will not tarry. Then that phrase that made all the difference in the dark ages, in the Reformation, for the just shall live by faith. It's that phrase, not necessarily the same scripture reference, but the just shall live by faith. In that day, a man by the name of John Tetzel went around. He was one of the heads of the church, the church of that day, and he went around selling indulgences. So what happens was they prepay for funerals. Well, John Tetzel developed this idea of prepaying for your sin. What do you want to do? Well, I want to kill my neighbor. He makes me mad. Oh, man, that's a big one. That'll cost you $5,000 to the church. But if you pay your money, then it's forgiven ahead of time, so you can do whatever. And he even made up a little jingle. That moment when the coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. And he actually sold indulgences. You tell me what you'll do, what you want to do, I'll calculate it. Okay, that'll be so much. You give me your money and you can commit any sin you want to commit because you've paid your dues. Martin Luther said, the just shall live by faith. He said, you're not going to earn your way into heaven. You're not going to buy your way into heaven. You've got to do it by faith. But we are not of them who draw back unto perdition, but of them that believe to the saving of the souls. And then it goes right on into chapter 11. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We're to be people of faith. I've spent all of my adult life in ministry working with kids and teens. I've seen some that were really abused and really gone through some horrific things. And one of the things that marks those children is they don't trust anybody. And you say something loud and they jump. Or you're there and, you know, a bug flies by and you swat at it and they jump. Or you say, okay, now I'll come back and then I'll take you to get what you need. And they sort of roll their eyes. Yeah, right, I've heard that before. I'll never forget, we had a boy named Travis. He was in seventh grade. And Travis was from a very troubled home. And one day he came to school, and I mean to tell you, he was in trouble from the very first step on the grounds. I mean, he was just cantankerous. He was doing things on purpose, just giving everybody fits. They brought him down to my office, and I had worked with him before, and there was a lot going on, and I was a little frustrated with some other things that were happening, and I looked at him. I said, now, Travis, you sit there in that chair, and I don't want to see you move at all until I tell you to. I said, this is ridiculous. I said, you know exactly what we expect. You know exactly what you have to do when your teachers have to do it, and you're just doing the opposite on purpose. And all morning, teacher after, every class, every teacher, every person, adult that you come, they're coming and telling me, say, man, what's going on with Travis? He won't do anything. I've had enough. You sit there and behave yourself. And I thought, whew, took care of that. And a little bit later, I received a phone call from Bobo. Bobo was the older lady that he stayed with, sort of an adopted grandmother. She watched him when the parents who were in and out of the picture, mostly out, didn't show up. And she said, yeah, Brother Stett, are you somewhere where I can talk to you? Well, Travis is sitting right in front of me. He's sitting there all sullen and sulking, and he doesn't care about anything. I said, Travis, go back to the learning center and sit in your seat. It was break time. He said, can I go on break? I said, no, you can't go on break. Just go sit in your seat. And I don't want to hear any more about any trouble. And he walked out, and I began to talk to Bobo. She said, I meant to call you a little earlier. You may have some trouble with Travis today. His daddy called and promised that he was going to take him fishing, and they were going on a camping trip this weekend and all of this, and he just built him up and he enticed him with some little gifts and this kind of stuff. And this was the dad's method of operation. He'd build him up and build him up and build him up until he was all excited, and then just jerk it out from underneath him. And so Travis was just bubbling over. He just wanted to get to school and get done with it because he's coming home and he's going to go on a camping trip with his dad. He's going to go fishing and they were going to go do this. And his dad was going to rent a boat and take him out on the lake and all this kind of. And he was just overflowing. And his dad came in and he said, oh, Dad, he said, you ready? He said, can't wait to get. And his dad looked at him and said, you stupid idiot. You didn't really think I was going. You know me better than that. I'm not going to waste my time with some rotten punk like you. And about 5 minutes later, he got on the bus and came to school. And suddenly I felt about that tall. Because rather than than anticipating and understanding, and I knew there were problems, but I was frustrated, you see. And I went into the learning center, and there was Travis He had his head down. Just as I walked in the door, I saw heard him sniff, and I saw him wipe tears from his face. And I made it worse. There wasn't anyone else there. And I went over and got down on my knees and wrapped my arms around Travis. And I said, Travis, I owe you an apology. I had no idea. And I was frustrated, and I snapped back at you. I said, you understand that you can't do the things that you were doing this morning. But I was completely out of place. I was totally insensitive. And I'm sorry. He said, oh, that's all right. I didn't want to go anyway. He said, but I'll never trust a word my dad says again. It's a trust problem. You know, that happens in the church world. And bad things happen, and we get knocked around, and we're bruised and battered. And it's hard for us to really trust. It's hard for us to trust our brothers. Brother Jackie, I don't trust you. It's not anything that you've done. But I was mistreated by him and her and him and them and those. So I have a hard problem. You know what I mean? It happens in our world today. Wow, this is turning out to be a whole different sermon than I had planned to preach. Sorry. I'm not sorry. I take that back. You know, we could go down through here and we could see all of these heroes of faith, and that's so important. And I love to preach from Hebrews 11. I really do. There is one section that I want to focus on, and that is the part about Moses. All right? Let's look at these verses together. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 23 through 28. It says, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents. All right? Now, we know it was by faith, but it wasn't the faith of Moses. He was just born. So he was hid for 3 months by faith, but it was the faith of his parents. All right? Because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith Moses, now we're talking about Moses' faith. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Let's stop there. No, let's see. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So let's look at this faith of Moses. The first thing that we see, excuse me, is the foundation of Moses' faith was begun in the life of those that raised Moses. His parents had faith. It was by faith that they hid him from the Pharaoh that had the power to kill them, and they hid him because their faith was in a God that they realized had put his stamp of approval on Moses even as a baby. And so their faith in God caused them to deny what the Pharaoh did, and they hid Moses for those months because of their faith. And so the foundation of Moses' faith had its seed or its roots in the faith of someone else. Let me talk to you that are parents. You will establish the foundation and the framework for your children's faith by the faith they see in you. We grew up in a family that was close-knit. There were six kids and mom and dad, so there were eight of us. We were poor as church mice, all right? I mean, we were poor and poor and poor, and we were so happy we didn't even know the difference. I didn't realize until I was a grown-up person just how poor we were. We went with six kids. We lived for about a month over 2 years, so 25 months we lived without a car because our car blew up and we didn't have money to get another one. And so we walked all over. We walked all over Cincinnati. We would walk about 10, 12 blocks down to Finley Market, the A&P store, and we would buy all the groceries we could have. If we had any pennies left over, we would rent a taxi one way to take us back up the hill because it was all back up steep hills, all the way back up on top of what we call the hilltop. And if not, we walked carrying the bags. At that time, $20 would buy so many bags of groceries that all of us had our arms full. And if we didn't have enough left over for a taxi, we made a game seeing who could walk the most blocks in the sidewalk before we got tired and had to set it down. So it was a contest all the way. We just had a ball. I loved going to the store and walking back carrying grocery bags because next time I was going to meet my brothers. I was going to beat them. Didn't have sense enough to realize that I was so poor that we didn't even have money for a car. I thought it was all a game. All right. But I tell you something. My mom, as I said last night, had a simple faith in God that was just astounding. And my father did the same thing. When we had a need, in family devotions, we would gather around. Mom and Dad would say, look, this is our needs. This is how much this bill is due by this day. We need this much. We're going to pray, and then we're going to join our hearts together now and pray as a family, and then we're going to pray individually, and we're going to sit back and watch and see how God chooses to answer that prayer. And he would answer that prayer, and we'd come back together again, and we would rejoice, and we owed $13.29, and the Lord sent in some money, and when we counted it was $13.29, exactly what we needed, and we were praising God, and I remember as a little kid being so happy, and a lot of times I'd clap. We were celebrating that God had answered our prayer. What were my parents doing? They were planting the seeds of my faith. They were helping it. They were watering it. They were helping it to grow. I'll never forget when we left Cincinnati and moved to Salem, Ohio, up to Allegheny Wesleyan College. And I never had lived anywhere but Cincinnati. And that's a big city. And we moved to Salem, Ohio, and it was like the boonies. I mean, it was farm country. I thought, what in the world do they do out in a dead place like this? We looked out our kitchen window and saw the second largest Jersey dairy farm in the state of Ohio. And I said, there's nothing but cows and trees. I was used to concrete and lights and asphalt. And I was going into my sophomore year of high school, and all of my friends were gone, and everything was changing, and I was so frustrated. We moved up there. My dad had got a job working at Wilson's Dairy down on Reading Road through the summer. And so on the weekend, he moved us up there. And then he had to run back on Saturday so he could be there for work on Monday. And it was Mom and my brother Daryl and my sisters Frances and Trelinda and me. So there's five of us. And we were up in Salem, and they were supposed to have the house ready. And when we got there, as is typical with Bible colleges, they didn't have everything ready like they had thought they would. And we just moved everything in, and it was a mess. And we had problems with the truck, and we had to have a repairman to come out and fix it because we were sitting for 3 hours along the side of the road. And we got there late on Saturday, and we didn't even have time to unload everything hardly. We did bring in some essentials, and we set up a table and all of this. And it's Saturday night, and tomorrow's the Lord's Day. And I was so tired and grouchy, and I said, Mom, what are we going to do tomorrow? Here it is 11 o'clock at night. We just drug the mattresses out and laid them on the floor so we could sleep. We had a table set up there. I said, we don't have any food in the house. We don't have a car and any way to go. Now we're out in the middle of nowhere in a cow pasture, and it's like 5 or 10 miles to town. It wasn't that far, but it seemed like it from Cincinnati. I said, what are we going to do? She said, Steve, we're going to do what we always do. I said, yeah, right. Trust God, right? She said, yep. That's what we're going to do. So we gathered in the living room, sat on the floor because the couch was still on the truck. And my mom said, God knows where we are. God sent us here. We're doing exactly what God asked us to do. And we had problems that were unavoidable. And we got here, and we're in a bad place, unprepared for the Lord's day. But it's God's day, and we're going to honor him, and we're going to trust him to supply our needs. I didn't get too involved in the prayer that night because I was hungry. We got up the next morning, and my mom, as was normal on Sunday morning, she said, okay, Steve, before we go out the door, you need to set the table. For what? We don't even have any food. She said, I know, but the Lord will provide our food. You set the table. So I set the table. And we had some friends that we knew that came by and took us to church. And we came home from church, and I said, okay, now what do we do? She said, well, we go wash our hands, and we change into out of our church clothes so we don't get them all messy, and we come down, and we get ready to eat. And so we did. And she said, Francis, put ice in the glasses, and Terlinda, you make sure that there's napkins there and all of this, and we're gonna get ready to eat. And so we got ready to eat, and I got this smirk on my face. And we come in around the table, and we sit down. And I said, now what are we going to do? She said, now we're going to pray and thank God for supplying our needs. We're going to thank him for the food that he provided. And I said, you must be seeing something I'm not, because it doesn't look like you're. She said, just wait. I said, okay. So we prayed. And my mom, it is etched forever in my mind. She sat at the head of the table, and she said, now, Lord, you've given us the opportunity to prove your word. Thank you for giving us that opportunity. Thank you for trusting us with this. This is a difficult time for our family, and I need you to be God to my kids right now. And in that moment, there was a knock on the front door. She said, we give you all the praise for what you have provided for us to eat. Amen. Steve, go answer the door. And I went to the front door, and some longtime friends of my mom and dad, Bob and Marilyn England, I think you know them maybe. Marilyn England was there, and she said, God told me yesterday I was supposed to fix me a meal for you. And her two boys and her two girls and her husband and she herself began to bring in pans and bowls and platters and pies and cakes and freezer jam and butter and all of that kind of stuff. And they just walked in, and they said, where do you want it? My mom said, you can put the meat right there. Well, what about the other meat? Well, you better put that down there. And, well, here's mashed potato. You can put that right here. And here's scallop potato. Well, you better put them down here. And here's this kind of salad and this kind of salad and this kind of salad. Well, we'll put one there and one there and one here. And here's two different kinds of rolls. And here we brought 3 pies and 2 gallons of ice cream. And where are we going to put that? What was my mom doing in the middle of the most difficult time in my life that I ever remembered to that point? She was still busy planting seeds of faith in my heart. Until when I was living in Bedford and I had my own 2 kids. And there was a problem with my tax returns. And I thought I had figured them right, and I checked them just before I sent them, and I realized that I owed money to the IRS, and I didn't have, I think I had $5.16 in the bank. And I said, "Beth, what are we going to do?" She said, "We're going to get the kids in here in the living room, and we're going to tell them what we need, and we're going to get on our knees and trust God." And so we did. We knelt on the floor in a circle in our living room, and I explained what it was, and Kent looked up at me and said, "Daddy, that's nothing for God." And we prayed, and we were getting up off the floor when the phone rang, and this funny lady that went to our church, she was a good lady, but she was several French fries short of a happy meal. And she would get up and do funny things in church and this kind of stuff. And she would call me sometimes and have something that I needed to fix on her trailer. And she said, "I need you to come. I got something to give you." And I rolled my eyes and I went down there. In the meantime, I said, "Lord, what do I do?" He said, "Write the check and put it in the mail." Well, you don't want to write a rubber check to IRS. That just doesn't work. And I said, "Lord, that's criminal. He said, "No, you write the check and put it in the mail. I want you to do that before you go to her house." And so I did. And I went down and I told the kids that. I said, "Now this is serious, so we need to pray that the Lord..." And I went down to Edna's house and I said, "What did you need me to do?" She said, "Oh, I didn't need you to do anything." She said, "The Lord woke me up at 4 o'clock this morning and told me to write a check to you." And she said, "Here it is." And she had this way of humming, and she was walking across the floor going, "Doo, doo, 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 doo," and here it is. And I sort of smiled and thanked her and said my goodbyes and went out and got in my car. And out of curiosity, just before I drove off, I opened that check, and it was to the penny of what I wrote to the IRS. I mean, it was down to the exact cent. And my check was already in the mail. And God had already written a check to take care of it. And I went home humbled. And I called my kids together, and we knelt again on the floor. And I said, "Kids, you're going to have to pray for your dad today, because I didn't really have the faith that I needed, but you did." And Kent and Maria patted me on the back. "That's all right, Daddy. You normally do good." And we celebrated and rejoiced and praised God. And then I jumped up and signed that and ran to the bank. But to the exact, the foundations of that were established by my parents. They were people of faith. And when put to the test, I became a person of faith because I had seen it work. We were coming back from North Carolina visiting my mother's family. We had an old 57 Rambler station wagon. And that was going down old 52, just curves and mountains and hairpin curves. It was a disaster. And we were coming back, and we were somewhere down in Tennessee or Kentucky maybe. And suddenly that car just went dead. And we coasted off to the side of the road, and we looked across the street, and there was a mechanic shop right there. Guy was running a mechanic shop out of his garage. And my dad said, "Well, thank the Lord, we broke down right here in a mechanic shop." And we went over and we got there, and the guy came and looked at it, and we pushed it up his drive, and he looked at it, and he came out and he said, "Mr. Stetler..." No, we didn't push it up his drive. He's checking it right there, and he checked some things, hooked up a couple of instruments, and he said, "Mr. Stetler," he said, "I'm sorry to say, but this car will never run again." He said, "It's just absolutely worn out. There's no compression in the engine. There's all kinds of problems." He said, "I'll be glad to call a tow truck and tow you in. My dad said, no, that's all right. And he went back across the road. And my dad came and sat in the car. We were all in there, all of our family. And he said, we're going to get out and we're going to circle this car and we're going to lay our hands on it and we're going to pray for the car. And we did. And he said, now let's get in and go to Cincinnati. And we got in and my dad turned the key and it started. We drove all the way to Cincinnati. And when you came into where we parked, where the ramp goes up into the current parking lot, we used to live where the parking lot is, and there was a little parking thing right down there on ground level, but you had to go up over the sidewalk and down into it, and just as we went over there, that car died out, and it never ran again. Not a single time. But we drove it 274 miles after the mechanics said it had never run. My dad prayed, and God healed a car so we could. He said, God, I remember his prayer. He said, God, we have given our life to your service, and we're doing exactly what you've asked us to do. And we didn't have money to buy another car, and now you're able to help us to get home. So what happened when I was driving, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and my car quit, and my wife and my 2 small kids were in there, and we were in a dangerous area. What did we do? We didn't get out and lay our hands on the car. I just said, I remember when I was a kid, my dad prayed and God healed our car and helped us to get home. And we're going to pray right here. And so we laid our hands on the console and prayed. And Kent said, Daddy, what are we going to do now? I said, we're going to start the car and go home. That's big words. That's big words. And I put, with trembling hand, I put my key in the ignition and I turned the crank and it fired and we drove home. Kent said, oh, cool, Dad. I said, no, thank the Lord. He did what he said he would do. The foundations of Moses' faith were planted in the hearts and lives of others. But then we see that faith is not a passive something. Faith makes a choice. Did you notice what it says there? It says, by faith Moses, so now we're talking about his faith, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He had the opportunity to be the up-and-coming prince. He had an opportunity to live in the palace. But by faith, he looked back at what his parents had taught him in that little time they had with him. And he said, And he compared it to here. And he said, nope, I'm not doing it. I will not be Pharaoh's daughter. And so faith makes a choice. Faith said, no, I'm not going to do that. So we see that it has its initiation in the life of someone else, that it makes a choice. It is active. The third thing, and then we see that the reason of that, we see the function of faith. It says no, it makes a choice, and we also see that faith has a value system. What does it say there in verse 26? Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure of Egypt. So it's like there was this giant balance out there in Moses' mind. And on one side was all of the riches of Egypt. And on this side was the affliction and the suffering of God's people. And when Moses put it on the balance, it weighed in God's direction by faith. And so faith is active. It says no. It makes a choice. It says no. It has a value system. And then we also see that it has a measuring stick, and that when Moses was faced with a choice, with a decision, we see the vision of faith. And he said, hang on a minute. He said, let me check this out. And he runs and he gets up high where he can see beyond all of the stuff of this world. And he says, he's looking at that city that's been promised, and he said, nope, there is no way I'm going to tie myself down here. because he was able to see beyond, see what no one else could see. His eyes were fixed on the prize at the end of the way. And so that faith lifted him above all of the problems and the difficulties around him, and he was able to see by faith the promise that God made him. And then we see that we see the fulfillment of faith in verses 32 through 40. It says that all of these people that finish out this chapter from Moses and on down, and then we see Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel, and all of the, we see all of these people, and we see the fulfillment of faith. It says in verse 39, all of these obtained a good report. Why or how? They obtained a good report through faith. How is your faith tonight? Is it passive? Do we just treat it like, oh, we just send up a little prayer and, oh, well, it didn't work, so try again next time? Or is it something that is solid and rooted and we build upon it? And it's not just hit or miss, but it is just carefully placed in, and we keep building and going higher and higher, and we have some point of reference where we remember what took place in the past, and we remember the promises of God, and we make a logical, a well-thought-out decision because of the faith that we have. And someday, that faith will be rewarded. I say, Lord, help us with our faith. Increase my faith. Increase my capacity to believe. And help me to really put my faith and trust in God. There's a whole lot of things there. I got too tied up in telling stories. I appreciate you being here. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to roll our cares onto you, to put our faith and trust in you. We don't have to spin off on one side or another, but in this walk of faith, we are walking together with you toward that ultimate prize of someday being in your presence for all eternity. Help us with our faith. Help us to have a proper balance in our life and a measuring stick that we can compare the things that this world offers and understand that the things of faith are beyond our comprehension, from another world. Increase our faith, we pray. Now, keep your hand upon us as we go home and bring us back safely for a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. For all that you do for us, we'll praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for your attention. You're dismissed.